Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and on this podcast, I speak with founders, investors, and domain experts from the Indian Valley, trying to understand the art of building a legendary company. In this episode, I speak with Monish Darda, co-founder and CTO of Icertis. Icertis is the global leader in contract lifecycle management, building a world-class SaaS giant from the heart of India. Valued at more than $3 billion, Icertis is not just leading the CLM wave, but it is now building the ecosystem for CLM in the world. One of the largest SaaS startups from India, Icertis was started by serial entrepreneurs Samir and Monish from Pune in 2009. Monish is a tech veteran who has been a part of multiple ventures in the past. His humility and insights are unparalleled, and this conversation is a true testament of it. Through this discussion, I pick Monish's thoughts around a bunch of unique aspects in the pursuit to understand how they've built Icertis. This includes aspects around the ecosystem approach to product expansion, the focus on people and having fun while creating a shared culture for the same, and further diving deeper into many of Monish's personal thought processes around productivity, experience, and the motivation behind being a founder. Thus, without further ado, let's dive in to the 66th episode of the Indian Silicon Valley podcast, Building the Global CLM Ecosystem with Monish Darda of Icertis. Thank you so much, Monish, for joining me. I'm truly honored to be hosting you today.
Jivraj, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you so much for that, Monish. And I am too, because I'm so excited, especially building up to the episode, looking at how Icertis does a bunch of things differently in both the qualitative aspects of entrepreneurship and the quantitative ones, right? And thus, I want to make this conversation a mixture of both. To start off with, I want to commence with what I found very fascinating about your journey, right? Because you are the kid who went to the US to pursue his higher studies, but came back immediately. And since then, you've been in Pune, built out of India for the world. And that just speaks volumes of how humble, staying true to your roots, as they call it, right? That phrase is personified by your journey. So if you can just give us a quick overview of what brings in that mindset in you and how have you inculcated it from the start, I think that'll be a great cue for all of the aspirant young Indians wanting to build for the world from the country.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question as well. I think, you know, you kind of mentioned coming back to India after going to the US for your master's. I actually have to give all my credit to my mom. I think what happened was when I said I want to go to the US, at that time, you know, nobody came back, right? I mean, it was like 99.999% of the people who, this was the time of the, you know, the news, big news was the brain drain. How much of, you know, India's talent was going out and not coming back. And my mom said, if you want to go, promise me that you will come back after you finish your master's. And I kept my promise. That's all I did. But, you know, that's the reason I got back. But it's an interesting thing, you know, that brain drain actually then converted to evolution of our IT industry, right? The IT services industry actually blossomed because there were so many Indians who went there in the US and they were the ones who got the plugs in for companies here. And, you know, that's where the IT revolution in India really started. So everything happens for a reason. And I think coming back to India for me was also, you know, was a very good reason and a very fulfilling reason. I think the interesting part at that time, and, you know, I went into entrepreneurship in about 3 years. So, you know, I worked for 3 years. That was my only, actually, if I remember right, well, I do remember right, I guess, that was my first and only job that I did. For the rest of my career. So I worked for 3 years. Then I spent another year in the US, actually in the dot-com boom, where, you know, I was contracting in the Bay Area, which was a lot of fun, actually. And then came back and started my own company. And then, you know, it's been 7 startups since then, which I've been part of or founded. And Icertis is the 7th. So that's the journey. And it's been interesting, as always, because India has always been a fantastic place to build stuff, right, build software. And Pune, especially the ecosystem after Bangalore, has been very rich for a long time. And I think that has made, you know, things easier. And that's made things phenomenal in terms of, you know, what we have achieved as outcomes, as teams that are built in Pune, as the ecosystem has grown, as, you know, more and more companies have come to Pune. We now have, you know, 3 unicorns in Pune, which is quite amazing. And then 2 on the same street, you know, so that's been very interesting. But the way things have grown, I think it's been quite a journey for Pune as well. And personally, you know, back to my roots, it's been fantastic.
Absolutely. No, that completely shows, and you've championed the cause for it. But, you know, double clicking from there, and since we're at the subject, I wanted to also click on the fact that post your acquisition, and this is the precursor to the iCertis journey, right? I mean, that is also the time when a lot of founders, maybe at least from the external world, it can seem like you've reached the epitome of what a founder may need as success, right? You've perhaps reached, you know, you've gotten the acquisition, you've generated wealth for a bunch of your employees, yourself, for the ecosystem, and all of that, right? But I remember starkly where you mentioned that after the acquisition, you were like, what next, right? Because that's the entrepreneur. Entrepreneurial grit, right? So talk to us about what entrepreneurship, what building means for you, because you've been a builder for as long as I have observed, for as long as you have mentioned, and your 30 years of journey. I might be getting the numbers slightly wrong, but 7 startups, right, as you mentioned. So talk to us just about that entire flow of what goes into your head of being a builder and what that manifests as with your startups.
No, that's a great question. Actually, there is, you know, I've been thinking about this because that is how you also find your co-founders, right? So what are you looking for in a co-founder? What are you looking for within yourself? And I think there are 4 things that pop into my mind. I think one is, you know, what you go through yourself when you are part of a startup, and that's patience, right? You need patience with your family. You need patience with your co-founders. You need patience with your customers, your employees, the whole ecosystem. So patience is a very, very big, very critical virtue, right? The other is, so you look at what you go through, then you have to have the empathy for what others go through because of your journey. And that applies to your family and your co-founders and your customers and your employees as well. Because sometimes you're struggling with money and, you know, balancing your work and life. Sometimes you're just not agreeing with your co-founder. Sometimes your product is not ready, but you've already sold it to the customer. So you have to figure that out, and so on and so forth. So empathy is the second, I think, you know, very important and a critical part of, you know, how the persona kind of evolves in my mind. The third and probably the most important thing, especially when I've looked at my failures and my successes, is how do you separate your passion from your emotion? I think the first thing you do as a founder is you have to be passionate. Otherwise, you can't really build, right? You have to have the patience, the empathy. For that to kind of sustain over a period of time, you have to have a lot of passion for what you're doing. But you also have to really learn the ability of, you know, separating that passion from emotion. And that's where things like acquisitions come in. When are you ready to quit, right? And quit is a strong word. But sometimes you fail and you have to be ready to quit. Sometimes you're acquired and you have to be ready to quit. Sometimes you're thinking about, hey, what next? And, you know, there's a better option. So, you know when to quit. So all of this actually kind of breaks down into this, you know, separation. Very, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, work-life balance. I think this emotion and passion balance is equally important. You know, you have to make sure emotion actually stresses you out, right? And passion helps you build. So you have to have, you know, both these things very well balanced. And the last one, you know, for you to enjoy that journey, for you to really learn at every point, and for you to really feel that journey, so that, you know, first of all, you don't miss that passion, or you don't lose that passion, or you don't lose that patience and that empathy. You need to be in a state of mind called flow. Right? You have to be in the flow. You have to enjoy those times. You have to really enjoy what you're doing every day. You have to look forward to the bad days and then love those, you know, great days when you close a customer or you hire a great person or you raise funding or whatever, right? So that flow is equally important. I think those are the 4 things that probably make a good founder in general, right? And You know, there are obviously others, you know, you have to have a risk appetite and you have to be very perseverant and all of that. But I think these four things kind of, you know, are the core of everything that you do as a person. You said builder, I would say not just builder, but an engineer, because you're not building, you're also thinking about what to build, how to build, what are the tools, you're collecting them, you're designing, planning, etc. And then you start building. So it's really the job of an engineer. And it becomes very interesting, you know, to think about it that way. And when you get acquired, and you're probably referring to Blade Logic, which was before Icertis, and we sold Blade Logic to BMC Software. It was very interesting. 2007, we actually went public on the NASDAQ. That was one of the most successful tech IPO that year. So we were already on an emotional high going public, right? And then selling to BMC was a very interesting decision, because when we went public, we thought, you know, we had come to a stage where, wow, everything looked green and there were no greener pastures along the way. So that was a good time for the founders of Blade Logic. You know, I set up the India office. I was a very early employee, but that was when we decided, hey, this is a good, this actually makes a lot of sense. And that's how the acquisition happened. But with Icertis, what has happened is we said, you know, we could be a $100 million company. We went there, we said, oh my goodness, there's a lot to be done. We turned unicorn in, I think, 2019. And we said, oh, you know, we knew this was coming, nothing new, what next? And then now we are, you know, we raised a round at almost $3 billion post money. And it feels like, you know, there's lots to do here. It's just the beginning of the journey. So you are in a state of mind and a state of the company that you are actually thinking, hey, even separating out the emotion from the passion always wins in these circumstances.
No, that's wonderful to hear. I mean, for everyone listening in, I think, especially for me, as I hear this, it just drives that emotion of, as you mentioned, engineering things, right? And having that strong sense of passion that you can balance out and being in the flow, especially. I love that pointer. And that's been very evident, because whenever I've heard you or your co-founder speak to me, right, there's been this evident sense of enjoying the journey, having fun along the way. The Goa board meetings, which are very famous, right? And we will go to that reference as well. But it's just amazing how, I guess, does it all come with experience? Or are these learnings, like, I don't know, like, it's very difficult to grasp as a youngster that, you know, because you hear these things of hustle, right? You hear all of the things where you have to do the grind, and I'm sure it becomes rosy after a point, and it's amazing, right? I remember you mentioning that you love most of the journey, right? 360 days, maybe not five. And how does that happen? I mean, just talking it from an experience perspective, does it have to do with time? How do these realizations come along the way? And when do you have to make peace with it, when you let go of the traditional beliefs and actually start enjoying the journey? I think that'd be a very good, interesting double-clicking pointer.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's another great question. You know, there's been a lot of retrospection, you know, as we've grown in Icertis, because, you know, in my previous life before Icertis, I had to change. I mean, change is kind of, you know, the only constant, right? In everybody's life, you have to change for several reasons. And I had to change, and I probably changed maybe once in five, six years. And when I change, I mean, you know, you're actually changing what you are almost, right? So not the fundamental things that you believe in, not the fundamental kind of personality or values and so on, but you change yourself as a person, your behavior, the way you look at things, you know, especially if you have kids, you know, they kind of bring a different kind of lens to life. You start thinking about things very, very differently. And I used to change maybe once in five, 6 years, right? In all of my professional career. In Icertis, you know, what I've realized, and Samir and I both realized, we talk about this every year at the end of the year. We both changed every year. So the pace of change and the realization that, hey, for this kind of a growth to be sustained for this level, where you've not done things before in your life at all. I've never run a $3 billion company, or Samir hasn't run a $3 billion company anyway. But it's interesting to see that as you learn, how do you kind of change yourself to make sure that this actually happens? And that realization actually then just speeds up, right? So if you think about when I started my first company in 1997, I didn't have too many entrepreneurs or founders to talk to. We hardly had, you know, small startups in Pune at that time. There were very few. There were a couple of ones that were actually successful. And then there were, you know, a few that were kind of been a family business, you know, lifestyle business. So they were not growing, but they were there and they were enjoying what they were doing. But they were still, they never had this urge to look beyond, you know, a lifestyle business. But now you have so much opportunity. You have, you know, things like Coursera where you could take a, you know, course on how to become a founder, right? Lots to learn there. So now the transformation is not that you don't have the data. You do have the data to learn and unlearn. But now you have a way to experiment. I think that realization probably really also supercharged that change in both Samir and I in terms of, hey, there is, you know, let's try things. If things are not working, why don't we try things? Different things, you know, lateral things. And I think that makes a founder in today's economy and in today's India a very different animal than what we were, you know, two decades ago. And I think that makes it also, you know, just, you know, if I think about, you know, we took 9 years, 10 years to build a unicorn. I think now the younger founders will probably do it in 1, 2, 3 years. I think that's so exciting, right? Because there's so much learning there. There's so much realization there. There's so much that you don't want to do and you know that you don't want to do upfront. And there's so much you can do and will do. And, you know, how you measure your success and how you, you know, measure your emotion and so on and so forth. So I think that has probably been a big trigger in terms of realization.
Absolutely. No, that makes complete sense. And what I like the most is, you know, they say that the company keeps growing and the founders have to grow at the same pace because you can't, the company can't outgrow you. And the way you mention about the rate of evolution for you and your co-founder as you build iCertis, I think that's a great cue, especially for us as we look at, you know, life moving ahead and I'm talking about the young founders primarily here. But wonderful. I think this entire line of initial thought has been great and very interesting to observe. But, you know, as we go on to building iCertis and talking a bit more about that, before that, I want to take a step back and talk about the Indian global SaaS opportunity, right? As they mentioned, and that's the news of the season. It's a part of the buzz right now, but you've been doing this for long before it became a part of the buzz. It became sexy, right? Like it's now the buzzword, but it never was earlier. So what I'm trying to eye at is having been there in the trenches, having built part of this ecosystem that we now get to celebrate so that us youngsters can also, you know, look at it from an ambitious standpoint. Talk to us about how you've seen the evolution go, right? Like your narrative will be starkly different because you've seen it go. You've played a part in growing the ecosystem for Indian SaaS in the global context. So what has it been like to create a global company from India? What has it been like to sell to global enterprises from across the world? And how have you seen the ecosystem shape up? I think that would be a great narrative to just come from you and set the record straight maybe.
No, that's, you know, that's lots has been said about the Indian SaaS ecosystem, especially in the last 6 months to a year. And things become sexy when there are successes. And I think so, you know, iCertis is coming in as a unicorn, you know, a couple of companies with us, the first three unicorns in India in the enterprise SaaS space actually just made things really exciting. And, you know, and then the media kind of latches on as you know, right? So this becomes a very interesting thing. But, you know, if you kind of look at it, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I think the roots in this were, in my mind, two things. You know, one is the maturity of the Indian diaspora outside of India, especially in the US and Europe. And then secondly, the experience that the IT services companies just pushed through into the Indian software ecosystem. Just incredible talent, right? People who had worked with the Googles and the Microsofts and the Salesforces of the world, building businesses, doing all of this as IT services from India, but going through that journey, right? Just building that experience, building, you know, what it means, what it takes. You know, you rub off a lot of experience just working on things that are so beautiful, right? And I think that those two things came together, you know, many years ago, not just now. The other thing that happened, and I've seen this transition, you know, so vividly, is that you know, we went to work, you know, I took up my first job because I wanted to have bread on the table. It was a sustenance thing. If I didn't have a job, I didn't have money to buy food. I mean, it was, you know, in the 80s, that was the situation. And coming from a lower middle class family, that was very important to kind of figure out. Then came, you know, where, you know, what you did, the work that you did was actually the whole ecosystem and the economy brought a big change where people didn't work for sustenance because their parents had probably done that before for them. But they did it because they loved what they wanted to do. And that meant that, you know, you if you see software and evolution of the software industry in India, you'll see a lot of people in, you know, who have been in 10, 15 years in the IT industry, actually not take up that job 10, 15 years ago because they wanted to sustain, but because they wanted to get into software because it was fun and they loved it. So very different. Now you see youngsters, when we hire people fresh out of college, they don't have to earn the money. Their grandparents have probably done that to a certain extent. And obviously I'm thinking generics, right? This is average. There will always be exceptions both ways. Then there are people who have really enjoyed or have taken up jobs because they enjoy the job. Now you see people taking on jobs because they enjoy the ecosystem, the culture, the values, the experience. And they'll want to limit that experience to 8 or 10 hours. They don't want to work 16, 17 hours a day. And again, averages, right? Not exceptions. So now the whole kind of lens of looking at this has been, hey, how do I not just enjoy, but how do I create? How do I interact? How does this become a social aesthetic experience? And so there is a lot of emotional attachment to it. And there's an emotional change in terms of how you look at a job. And when that happens, you know, a very big change comes on the ecosystem. It is like what people used to say, you know, Akbar had the Navratnas in his Darbar. The only reason why art kind of blossoms is because, you know, war has been kept under control. People have more money. People have, you know, want to kind of explore different things than just, you know, sustenance and working. And they go into music, they go into films, they go into art, you know, all kinds of stuff. And that's the thing you're seeing right now. You know, my son is a bass guitar player. He goes to Berklee School of Music in Boston. So he's taken up music as a profession. And if I had done that, and if I told my dad I want to be a musician 30 years ago, I don't know what would have happened, right? Completely different kind of situation. But now when you do this, and when it comes to software, you get to see more founders come in. Because it's that now you want to create. You don't want to follow. You want to lead. You want to create. You don't want to create it from a spec, but you want to dream it up from scratch. I think that fundamental change in the software ecosystem in India in the last few years has been amazing to watch. So the people who come in convinced at, you know, 26, 27 years of age, saying, I want to build a $1 billion company in bus ticketing. You know, I want to build a $1 billion company in organizing, you know, events. I want to do, you know, integration between Salesforce and SAP, very specific stuff. I don't want to build a $1 billion company with aspirations and with, you know, they don't have fear. They don't think they are ill-equipped, that they need to have 20 years of experience, that they need to have, you know, $100 million in money. They just don't care. They know they can figure this out. Now, that is a sea change. One is because India probably is the youngest country or one of the youngest countries in the world. Big, young population, right? Which means it becomes easier when the economy is doing well, when people have money in their hands, it becomes easier for younger people to take more risk, which means you'll see more and more founders, which means you're probably, and I hope this turns out to be true, and you know, you can quote me at, you know, 10 years down the line, this is probably a much, much bigger wave than the IT services wave that India saw 25 years ago. This is not about building the next Infosys and the next Wipro. This is about building the next Salesforce. This is about building the next Palantir. This is, you know, about building the next Stripe. You know, billions and billions of dollars, not just unicorns, but, you know, 100 billion. And I think that's the opportunity we are sitting on today. Fueled by the young population, the spending power, the low cost of experimentation in India, you know, the whole world moving to Yeah, I'm okay taking a video call from India at 7 in the morning. No problem at all if it's a sales call. I've been used to it for the last 18 months in the pandemic. No big deal. That change, I think, which means it becomes much easier to sell from India without hiring $300,000 salespeople in the US, is going to just change this scenario. I'm really, really bullish about this, Jivraj.
Absolutely, no. And thanks to all of you who are championing the cause and making us believe in that success, right? Because only then do we get the conviction, as you mentioned, and, you know, become dreamy-eyed and start actually, you know, getting the conviction that it is as much possible as you guys have paved the way for. And it's just tremendous, as you mentioned. It has just been a transformative shift. And we hope that your adage ages well. And this is something that we can look back on 10 years from today and say that, you know, we called it out early. So wonderful to mention, like, hear that entire line and understand the narrative from your end, because the evolution is clear. As you mentioned, things have speeded up and it's just a awesome opportunity for every aspirant Indian who wants to build, right? So great to hear that, and wonderful segue to now going to, you know, iCertis. And I want to start with the early journey, right? The 0 to 1, perhaps. And with the context that I briefly mentioned, and this is like for everybody out there, that your first client was not exactly, you know, you didn't have contract management figured out. You had the co-founders figured, you had the space broadly figured, because enterprise was something that attracted all of the co-founders. But then Microsoft came in with this side, outsourced problem, right? And that was like the first client story. And that led to contract management, right? So if you can give us more context to that journey, also with the fact that how founders can perhaps approach this, right? Because there can be 2-3 ways of starting a problem, right? You either go after like a very huge market, or you have a very huge problem that you really, really want to solve, or you have a phenomenal team. And in this case, you went with the latter, right? So if you can talk to us about that entire journey with context to how this particular approach work best for you, I think that would be wonderful to understand from a more starting up lens, as a lot of us contemplate which the best way might be.
Absolutely. And you know, and these are all experiences, right? So you have to find your best way as a founder. Every company has been different, you know, every situation has been different for me as well. But what was interesting was, you know, and I love Samir's, we call them Samirisms, you know, he, you know, very early on, he said, we should ride a wave or create a wave. You know, we didn't think we are immodest people. We are not that immodest. We didn't think we could actually create a wave. So we said we should ride a wave. At that time, the cloud was really, really getting into the enterprise. Well, into startups, not even in the enterprise. AWS was just coming up. Azure didn't exist in its form today. But we were seeing the investments that were happening in the cloud. And, you know, I came from that, you know, 1 year in BMC. I was looking at it from, you know, a large company lens. And the cloud was there on the horizon. You know, it was big enough and it was coming. So we thought we would ride the cloud wave. And we actually looked at, hey, what do we want to build? And, you know, this whole idea of what can I take to the enterprise, because both Samir and I come from enterprise background. So that was a natural market for us. What can we take to the enterprise where we don't have too many questions from the CIO or from IT saying, hey, I'm not going to go to the cloud. And this whole ERP surround thing was very interesting for us. So what happened was our surfboard became what we called the Applied Cloud Framework, a framework that we could build apps on, small apps on, that we could go and sell to the enterprise. And then one of them, as you rightly said, serendipity happened. You know, Microsoft came in, the, you know, old friend of Samir saying, hey, we just scrapped a CLM project. Would you like to take it on? You know, you are on the Microsoft ecosystem. You know, ISVs who are building on the Microsoft ecosystem. So, you know, why don't you do this? So Microsoft became our first customer. If you look at the, you know, whole journey, the way now I see it is kind of broken down in a very initial stages. You kind of find your surfboard to ride the wave. That's what we did early when we, you know, when we got a wave in terms of Microsoft, which we could ride with the right product. Then we took that product and we expanded it to a vision, right? And that's not always very easy to do. It's actually incredibly difficult to do, but you also need serendipity to happen. You also need, you know, that aha moment where you say, oh, this is actually not just limited to document management, because CLM in those days was really document management, glorified document management, right? There are like 120 companies worldwide who are doing some sort of CLM, you know, some small use case or, you know, large use case, but very niche. There was no platform. And we said, we already have a platform. Why don't we expand it to a vision? And the vision, actually, when we put it together in the early days of iCertis, was very interesting. We said that, you know, if I think about the contract, every dollar in and out of a company, if I trace it back, it lands in a contract. I'm hiring, I have to pay salaries, there is an employment contract. I'm buying, there is a procurement contract. I'm selling, there's a sales contract. I'm leasing, there's a leasing contract. I'm renting a car, there is a rental contract. You know, anything that an enterprise actually pays for or receives, there's a contract in the back. So we thought, hey, how about this vision? You know, if I improve this contracting process, I can actually make this money go in and out much more easily. And that is actually transformative for companies because I can give them a huge edge. And we said our vision would be then transform the foundation of commerce. So we started with that simple thought. We expanded our platform to a vision. And then we said, hey, our mission now to make sure that we can transform the foundation of commerce is to make sure that we can actually become the contract management platform of the world. So we smiled when we looked at that mission, but it was very interesting. And we said, let's execute on the mission. And that is how, you know, the last maybe 6-7 years of iCertis are defined, that you got to the mission and you executed on the mission for the last 4-5 years, where the vision is to transform the, you know, the foundation of commerce, where you're dreaming. And now in the stage that we are in today, I think the important stage or the important part of that evolution is to keep dreaming. Very interesting, because now you look at, hey, you know, it's unicorn, you know, we are now the CLM platform in the world. What next? You're up there with, you know, on the Forrester Wave and the Gartner Magic Quadrant. What next? How do you push yourself to the next milestone? What is that next milestone? And we said, you know what? Contract lifecycle management as a category is something we got there at the pinnacle that we wanted. But to get to the transformation of commerce, we have to do more than contract lifecycle management. And we pivoted the whole company to contract intelligence. So now you're dreaming of the next level. You're not dreaming about, you know, being the best in the business. You're dreaming about defining what is best in the business, which is a very big mindset change that we had to go through as a team, as a company, as a platform, as, you know, our messaging to our customers. I think that kind of gets you the scale. So the first few years were survival, then followed by growth, and now it is scale. It's all about, you know, how you become the next Salesforce and the next SAP and the next Stripe. You know, how can you kind of be all pervasive in a category that you have almost defined, right? And that becomes a completely different journey and a completely different learning and a completely different Monish and Samir kind of steering the company into that next thing. And hopefully we'll be able to do that. Otherwise, you know, we'll step down and get better people to do that. But I think this is an interesting part of the journey to kind of figure out, hey, if you keep dreaming, you can actually keep making magic. You know, and obviously luck has to come in and great people have to come in and the platform and the ecosystem and everything has to, you know, be serendipitously together, but it's possible. So long-winded answer, but it's been a lot of fun, as you can imagine.
Yeah, no, I'm in awe of that, because the way you talk about, you know, being as audacious as defining what's best in the business and creating another market altogether with the ambitious goals of becoming the next Salesforce of the world, which is definitely possible, as is evident from the journey and from your words. I think that just sets us up to, again, as I mentioned, be dreamy-eyed, because every time you do it or somebody does it and iCertis does it, we can look back and claim that, okay, if they can, so can we. And that is why we'll start. And that is how we'll go ahead and do it. So I think that was just wonderful to observe and get an overview of that entire journey in brief, right? Great, Monish. Further, as we proceed, as you talk about that contract lifecycle management to contract intelligence approach, and you've spoken in the past about the platform versus product mindset, right? If you can talk to us with that context about how you've looked at product evolution within iCertis and what's the cultural DNA that drives this kind of innovation, to make it easy for enterprises to actually look at contracts, to drive contracts and make it as simplified as it would be perhaps for a consumer product. Talk to us about how that platform approach has helped you develop the product in a magnificent manner such that it's helped you gain that market domination position now.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting evolution as well of not just thinking, but also the process of building, right? A process of innovation. I think the platform itself is a very overused word in software anyway. But if you keep that aside, the essence of it is essentially you don't want your customers to stop from migrating to a new version or just embracing, you know, the new features that you keep building. And you have always a challenge from an engineering perspective. How do you balance this generalization to specialization? You have large customers who are paying you a lot of money. They want things very specialized. If you want to generalize them, you know, you're going to take 6 times the money and 10 times the time to generalize. So there's always a balance between the generalization and the specialization. What we did, and you know, that's probably some of that experience rubbing off over the years of failures. What we did was we started with the assumption that we will first build for the customer, keeping the platform in mind. We assume, you know, that old system of you have $10, you know, which features would you put your money on? And that's how you prioritize, right? And you prioritize the generalization and the specialization exactly that way. That you have so many resources, you have so much time to deliver, you know, the time is not negotiable. The money is not negotiable. The people are not negotiable because you cannot hire overnight, even if you have the money. So how do you balance out the generalization versus specialization? So the big change in thinking happened when we said, hey, every release, we want to now allocate some money which is non-negotiable for this generalization, for platform features, which actually does not always end up as customer features. And that transition was very hard. If you can imagine in a growing company, when the CEO or the CRO tells you, hey, I have this customer, I have to have this feature, otherwise I cannot sell. Or the implementation team says, you know, worst, sales team has already sold this feature, now we want it, because now we are starting to implement. You want to balance that pressure against, you know, having a team set aside for making sure that you actually do the right things on the platform. So the balance there in my mind was not purity, because, you know, I've made that mistake myself of trying to be too pure to say, hey, my platform cannot be polluted. And that's not reality. But what you are actually now looking at is not purity, but agility. How quickly can you build something and throw it away and rebuild when you get the opportunity? I think that has been a massive change in terms of how iCertis has built the platform over the last 5-6 years. How do you have no shame in throwing something away and saying, I'm done with this. Life has ended. Move on, build it, you know, and kind of build it from scratch. I think that has helped us quite a bit. And that actually, to my mind, is the true test of a platform. Can you pull out chunks of things, throw them away and put new ones without disrupting the whole, you know, ecosystem of customers and partners and so on and so forth. So that's been, you know, one big learning in the process. That's been one way of thinking about, you know, what you mean by building a platform, not the purity of the platform, but how do you actually maintain the agility of the platform? And then all good, you know, engineering and software fundamentals, you know, you have to have loosely coupled and, you know, you have kind of figure out the solid principles. You know, you do software, right? But you also do product management, right? Because finally, this boils down to, you know, managing your product and the platform and the features. The other thing which was very interesting, Jivraj, and this is actually a little bit philosophical, if I may. We started with a product, first customer, we built it for the customer. You know, it was a product, not a platform, though it had the underpinnings of a platform. We made the evolution from the product to the platform because we knew that, hey, we are going to get enterprise customers, large customers. They're going to randomize us with all kinds of feature requests. So let's be prepared. So let's not build point solutions, build a platform. So our initial investment in building a platform was fairly high. Then we evolved that platform to a system of record. Now this becomes very interesting, right? Now your platform is not just something that you deliver features on for your customers, but now you make sure that the customers get so much value that they trust you with their master data. Just like when you think about CRM, you think about Salesforce or Microsoft CRM. When you think about enterprise resource planning, you think about SAP. You think about HCM, you know, you think about, you know, two or three of these applications that you would really go into. That is what we ended up doing for the CLM space, from platform to a system of record. And then now the journey we are on is, how do you take that system of record and evolve it to an ecosystem? So that you are not the only innovators. Now you bring your partners and your customers on the platform to innovate. Build an ecosystem from the system of record, from going not just mission critical, but finding new ways of being mission critical in different areas of the enterprise. I think that evolution has been, you know, a transformational way of how we think about the platform nowadays. We don't think about it as a mechanism of delivering features, as a mechanism of delivering configurations, but as a mechanism for enabling the ecosystem. And I think that that becomes transformative in terms of thinking. Now, you have some examples, right? Salesforce has done that quite well. SAP has done that quite well. There's a lot of, even if you think about it, Facebook has done it in the B2C space very well, right? Because, you know, you have these Facebook apps, you have these features that pop in, features that disappear. They can make changes very quickly to a very large user base. And that becomes an ecosystem, because Facebook is built on the ecosystem. And now you have a platform that actually becomes an ecosystem on its own to deliver features, to deliver, you know, news, fake or otherwise, and deliver it properly. And now you have this compliance to take care of, which is massive. But what happens is in that process, you kind of learn how to, you know, looking at these examples, you learn how to think yourself. And that becomes very interesting. The last thing I would say in this journey from being a product to a platform, to a system of record, to an ecosystem, is that, you know, this is from a founder's perspective, this needs two things. It needs discipline. Discipline in terms of, you know, not wavering because you hear things. Because as you grow, people tell you all sorts of things. And you go to people to hear them say these things, right? It's self-inflicted damage sometimes, right? But you listen to them, you don't necessarily follow them. Kind of have a very healthy mix of your gut and, you know, what you hear and your experience coming together. I think that becomes more and more difficult for a founder as the company grows, as the mission becomes bigger. And you have to be very disciplined to make sure that you don't lose that. The second one, which is also extremely critical in this evolution, is to make sure that you keep, you know, some part of, you know, whatever you have in terms of resources, money, people, expertise, time, separately for this ecosystem, for this system of record, for this platform. And that investment, which is, you know, when I was a kid, my grandfather used to teach me, you know, if you run, you know, you earn 1 rupee, you have to, you know, have 25 paise for yourself, 25% saved, 25 paise for, you know, doing good stuff, charity, and, you know, 25 for kind of helping your family. And that also applies to how you harness your resources and how you protect those resources from making sure that your discipline is lost, not lost because of the lack of resources. I think that, you know, discipline and that allocation of your resources actually helps quite a bit. And one of the things that we've done very well in my mind is that we've also taken that and allocated it to our values and culture. Because again, as I said, in software, it's all about people. And with the new kind of Gen Z or whatever happens after Gen Z plus, you want to give them an experience. And that experience has to be your values and your culture, you know, the way you treat people, the way people treat you, the way you treat outside people outside the organization, and how you define your lifestyle. Because now jobs are lifestyles. And I think that becomes incredibly important to protect. So that evolution has had these, you know, incredible learnings over the years. How do you, you know, build, how do you scale, how do you engineer this ecosystem over the years?
Certainly. And as I mentioned, wow, that was like almost like a masterclass on product to ecosystem, as you mentioned, and a change in thought process, right? The agility factor that you talk about, right? And being accepting of the consumers' needs, demands, markets needs, and evolving, I mean, at all instance. And as you mentioned, like retaining a certain amount of resource for that sense of innovation and looking 10 years down the line instead of just a quarter down the line. So I think that's fabulous to know and just inculcate that mindset. Further, you know, like as we enter to the last stages of what has been a phenomenal conversation, as you briefly elucidated on the culture aspect, the people's aspect at iCertis, and whenever, like leading up to the episode, I watched a ton of media articles, videos, interviews of both you and Sameer. And one common theme that was evident throughout every conversation was the emphasis on people, right? And that just reflects from the way both of you have carried yourself and feel, right? Because I'm sure that this is not concocted. This is something that is naturally intrinsic to both of you and has come over the years. So if we can double click on that and, you know, focus on how you've built such amazing people's practices, which include a sense of joy, fun, learning along the way, and is built on core values that really stand out, from the little things to, you know, those cultural values that say Forte, right? Like I know the full form, fairness, openness, responsibility, teamwork, and ease. Execution, yes. So if you can just give us that entire framework, right? How, what that means for you? And as experienced founders, how have you been able to inculcate that, build it down, and ensure that it flows at every piece of the organization? I think that would be all in all a great way to just grasp culture, especially at an organization of your scale and size.
No, and it's interesting. So Forte was a very interesting invention, I must say. You know, all companies have, you know, mission, vision, and values. So nothing different. You know, for my previous startups also, we had mission, vision, and values. You kind of had the values and the culture. Otherwise, you can't really sustain a startup. The R, by the way, is not responsibility, but respect. But I'll talk about it in a second. But it's interesting to kind of think about when you're small, when you have like 40, 50, 100 people, maybe even 200, you know, most people by name, you know, some of them, you know, their families, you know, some of them become very good friends. So the transformation of the culture, the definition of the culture, the bringing together of the values automatically happens. A small team kind of figures out over a period of time its own culture and its own values. They don't have to be on the wall. People know them. You know, this is acceptable, this is not acceptable. You know, you cannot be an a-hole, you can do this, you can get away with this, but this is the line, right? People know this, and they know this naturally because they're interacting so deeply every time. As you grow, as you distance yourself, you know, and you don't do it deliberately, but you have to, because you have to delegate to scale, you see this become more and more of a problem, because now you don't know what is happening at the edges of the company. New people coming in, old people, you know, or more experienced people who have been with you for a long time, getting jaded a little bit, if that's the word I'm looking for. Hey, whatever, you know, culture is, values are. How do you kind of make sure that you know, when these two meet, these two worlds intersect, that your values are not forgotten? And they are not just forgotten, but they are actually amplified and enhanced. So what we did was we actually spent some time figuring out, like one of our trigger points was an executive at a very large pharmaceutical company, one of the largest in the world. He, Sameer, and I were talking, and he talked about, you know, their values. And this is, you know, if you think about Johnson & Johnson, they have this credo. You know, if you think about any pharmaceutical company, because, you know, they're also, they actually are responsible for people's lives, if you think about, you know, the pharma world and the healthcare world and the provider world. So if you think about the credo, for example, it's something that every new person gets, you know, imbibed, you know, with, inducted with, you know, there are training material, there's video. And the way he explained their values was very interesting for us to hear. And that's how, you know, our first meeting with him started. You know, it started with values. And we said, yeah, this is a great way of thinking about how we scale. At that time, we were maybe 100, 120. So we're just at that edge of, you know, growing into where you kind of start distancing yourself a little bit. And that's how Forte actually came about. And Forte stands for fairness, openness, respect, teamwork, and execution. And we said execution, everything else, if you have the greatest values in the world and you're the most beautiful person in the world, you know, emotionally, you still cannot do anything if you're missing execution. So execution becomes a very critical part of all of this. But execution also has to be with focus, follow up and follow through. And when the agility part came in, we tweaked it a little bit and we said execution also means focus, follow up, follow through fast. Right? So you can't keep thinking about it. You have lots of focus, but now your, you know, time to market is gone or your window of opportunity has closed. So the speed is also important. So we coined this, interestingly, to say that, and Forte came as an acronym because it's easier to remember. So when you talk about this, even for me, if I didn't have the acronym, if you ask me, you know, after, you know, 10 years, Monish, what are your values? I would still probably fumble. My memory is not that good. But now I know Forte, I'll never forget. It's, you know, it's ingrained in my mind. It's very easy to remember. I think so that kind of, you know, we took this as a, you know, as seriously as we took our logo. You know, if you've talked to founders, you know how sensitive people are with their logo, right? They think about this, they really want this, right? The pixels and the colors and what it means and the story and all of that. We took the same pains that we took on our logo, on our values and the articulation of our values. The other thing which was very interesting was when you look at those values, it's not enough to tell people what the values are. You want to give examples. And you don't want to give good examples. Oh, I was very respectful. Oh, I was very open and I did this. Because good things, people say, yeah, yes, very good. They hear it once, they hear it twice, then they forget it, whatever. But you talk to them about your mistakes, where you were not fair, where you were not open, where you were not respectful, where you did not, you know, actually play, you know, your part in a team, where you failed in your execution. These negative examples actually reinforce this much better before. And we do that all the time. You know, every, you know, offsite, every senior leadership meeting, every all hands, every departmental all hands, we make sure we talk about, you know, our culture and our values, but you also emphasize where we made a mistake as a founder. We keep making mistakes. Nobody's perfect and we're still learning. So I think that makes things real for people. And when things are real, you know, Isersians bond in a way that is very special because they know what is acceptable. They know what the boundaries are. They know what does it mean to respond? What does it mean to execute? What does it mean to be open? What does it mean to be respectful? You know, whether you're asking for a salary hike or whether you're saying no to a salary hike, you know, very sensitive points. Respect becomes very critical in those conversations. Right? Openness becomes very critical in those conversations. Why didn't I get a raise? Is a very difficult question to answer in most cases, right? Same applies to customers. Why did your quality fall in this implementation? You know, you have to be open at that time, but, you know, making sure that you get your customers into confidence actually helps the overall mission. So these values have helped us in so many different ways, personally as well as professionally. It's quite incredible. And that's one of the learnings. If, you know, 10 years down the line, if somebody asked me a question like you know, maybe we do this podcast 10 years later and say, what is the one thing that you learned in Isertis? I would say it was the value of values. It's quite incredible to see, you know, how this has supported us since we were a young company, right? When we were 150 people to now that we are about 3,000. I think this becomes an incredible part of that journey we call Isertis.
Wow, no, that's wonderful. I mean, it's just so heartwarming to hear that the importance of people is just so up there and it's a priority and it's being valued. As you mentioned, I think that sums it up perfectly, right? The value of values needs to be known, needs to be inculcated, internalized, and then propagated, evangelized in the best possible manner, which is a testament to how you explained it. Wonderful. Great. I think I'm almost overwhelmed at that entire line of thought. But as we close down the episode, I'll perhaps ask a open-ended question here. But having started a SaaS unicorn, right, now that you are on the journey of hyper growth, if you had to give back 2-3 primary lessons in terms of core company building beyond the aspects we've covered in terms of product, culture, and team, if you could elucidate a couple of them really quickly, that would, I think, be very helpful for everyone building Corely for that set.
Yeah, I think there's very little that has not been said before. There's very little that founders already instinctively don't know. Every journey, as I said, is very special and very different. There are some fundamentals, we've already talked about. Having said all of that, I think one thing that, you know, I would take away from my journey for the last, whatever, since 1987, is really all this is about, everything is fine. You know, you build a company, you create. If you have a job, you can still create. It's your work. It's what you do. And you earn money, you get happiness in return, and you get a social life in return. And that's why people work. Whether they are founders or not founders, it doesn't matter. I think one thing to take away from all of this over the journey is to say, you know, it's an incredibly, incredibly satisfying feeling when you dream and the dream comes real, no matter how small or how big. I would say the thing that I've taken away from all of this is that the ability to dream and the passion to bring the dream into reality. I think both these are equally important. You can't just dream or you just can't be passionate. You have to make sure both of these come together. I think if you are a founder or if you're aspiring to be a founder, what I would say is don't miss on that feeling. Don't miss out on, you know, that's the most important thing in life after all is said and done. And if you can do that, if you can dream and then pick yourself up after that dream and start building to make that dream a reality, I think that will be fantastic. I've seen too many aspiring founders dream quite a bit, be passionate about it, but just go on endless loops in discussions. Should I build this? Is it there? Is it, you know, competition? Is it product market fit? I think the idea, if you dream, the journey of getting it into reality, whether it works or not, success finally is a factor. Lots of things depend on, you know, whether you're successful or not. And most of these things are out of your control. But to dream and to execute are not out of your control. And you shouldn't forget that.
Perfect. Wow. No, that's very, very powerful to hear. For the second last question, Monish, what does a calendar-obsessed Monish actually do on a day-to-day beyond the aspects of, you know, working towards that larger dream? Because what fascinates me the most is most founders are working towards this end nexus, right? That is just wonderful, that vision when it comes true, right? And that I think is a moving goal at each instant, right? When you must have started iCertis, it must have been a landmark or becoming that platform. Now it's the ecosystem and so on and so forth. But on a daily basis, we do these smaller actions that compound towards whatever that end goal might be, and it can be different for different people. But on a day-to-day basis, what keeps you motivated? What keeps you on your guard? What keeps you intellectually humble? And what keeps you going? I think that would also be very, very interesting to just ponder upon.
Yeah, interesting. And you know, to be humble doesn't come naturally to me. I'm a Leo. So it becomes very hard to be that. And that's a constant. I have a reminder pasted on the side of the monitor saying, hey, be humble. So, but I have to work on that. I think this is interesting. This is a very interesting question. I think this changes over a period of time. Every maybe 2 or 3 months, I keep changing what I focus on every day. But there are 2 or 3 that are constant. I'm a, you know, big kind of 7 habits kind of person, you know, mentally or tools-wise, you know, using it as a in Outlook or whatever. But I like prioritizing things and saying, hey, these are the 3 things I must do today, right? And these are the 2 things I can, you know, if something unexpected comes out, I can punt to next day. So that kind of helps me keep organized. And one of those is that, hey, I want to make sure that I can take a break every 60 to 75 minutes. It's very, very important for me. And that break could be anything, you know, just taking a walk, going out, playing a game. You know, I have these games that I love, which last for 2 to 3 minutes, right? Like you remember Counter-Strike used to last for 2 minutes, very similar. And that gives me a break from what I've been thinking about very hard or, you know, being a passionate discussion like this. I'll take that break after we finish. So mentally, it kind of, you know, makes me fresh for the next thing, for the next context switch. Or whatever I'm going to do next. I think the second thing I focus on is, you know, I keep asking myself, am I having fun? it's incredibly important to be deliberate about this, because sometimes you just forget to have fun. I don't know if you have had this feeling before. You're doing this podcast, in the middle of it, you get to such a serious conversation, you forget to have fun. I've had this feeling many times, and I have to remind myself, oh, this is not just work. You know, this is part of it, is to have fun. And then I create situations, I make people smile, or I smile myself. And, you know, I love people who make me smile. So I tend to kind of automatically gravitate towards them. So this is incredibly important to keep reminding yourself to have fun. And the ingredients of fun are all around us. Do we actually take those ingredients and convert them into having fun is very important. So that's the second thing I do on my agenda. I keep reminding myself to have fun in whatever way I do, whatever I do really. And the last thing, which is an interesting question, an interesting answer to an interesting question, is that I'm not a single, you know, one hobby and I'll do it deeply and passionately kind of person. I think my current hobby and my career and my goal is all iCertis. But I pick up many hobbies along the way. So you can see a telescope in the background with all the cloudy days that we have been having in the monsoons. My joy has been to just put together and assemble the telescope and just figure out, you know, software and hardware and integration. So I pick up these things and, you know, I think last month I never hoverboarded. I don't know if you have hoverboarded, especially with those powerboards. I got myself a hoverboard and learned to hoverboard, which was very interesting. So that's one of the things on my calendar, you know, giving some time to whatever my current hobby is today and just spending time on it on a daily basis as a discipline. I think that gives you, you know, much needed vent and a way to focus on, you know, things that actually bring you not just happiness and fun, but joy, right? You just really kind of excel. You need 5 minutes of joy every day for your sanity, if you're a founder, really. So those 5 minutes of joy are very critical. And I do that. And the last thing I would say, probably, again, I said it was an interesting answer to an interesting question. I just remembered one thing I always have on my calendar, which is probably a little bit more interesting, is I always have time on my calendar for my kids, one of my kids, to have a discussion. They've both grown up. But it's actually very interesting to have a conversation which is completely unrelated, whether it is LGBTQ+, whether it is, you know, what is happening in the Olympics or in Afghanistan. I think, you know, these 10, 15 minutes of conversation gives just a fresh perspective to the world. That's been actually a very important part of my calendar for a while, especially in the last 5-6 years. Lots of learning and lots of, you know, part of my change as a person has been that.
No, fabulous. I love those long answers, because I think so much of the things that you mentioned, right, they're not counterintuitive, but they're not as natural as they should be either, right? Like, so many of us forget to bracket time for joy, for our passions, for the things that truly matter, which are our human relations outside of work as well, right? The people that really matter, who stood by us and for whom we're all perhaps doing this, right? And we forget that in the hustle of life. And it's so important that you mentioned that, despite being in the stature that you are, right, like running a unicorn company, and I'm using unicorn as a label because we can relate with it, but the stature of the size and scale of your company, you could have mentioned, you know, so many meetings, so many things, I barely get time. But the fact that you've been able to bracket out time and you systematically do that just speaks volumes of what we need to prioritize from early on. And this is not just that can come later on, right? I think that's just a very, very important emphasis. And no, I love the calendar obsession. I remember I saw it earlier. And I also remember mentioning that your calls kind of stretch. And this conversation is also a testament to that. But it's been wonderful. And as we kind of, you know, go to the last question, I wish we could go on and on. But what I wanted to understand, and perhaps we sound a bit stereotypical here, but as you look back, right, in those years of reflection, not essentially the great parts or not essentially the failures, right? But every time you're perhaps stuck, right, and I'm sure there must have been multiple situations of the kind, what has perhaps helped you to zoom out, to take it as a steady state, right? Because we tend to often like become very high when, you know, like when the situation is great, become very low when it just goes down, right? But what helps you zoom out and still maintain control of the situation, if that begins to be so? But the entire emphasis being, if we can end with the thought of how you have been able to manage the low lights and challenging perspectives, I think that would be perhaps the best end I could expect. So over to you for the last one, Manish.
Yeah, absolutely. And there have been many failures, trust me. Lots of things that you thought would work didn't work. Lots of things that you set your mind to and just couldn't finish because, you know, something, a big roadblock came on your way. Lots of places where you couldn't get along with someone, though you tried very hard. So lots of failures, lots of failures. And I think that's one of the big joys of being a founder, that you actually have a lot more ups and downs in your life, more downs than highs, actually, which makes the highs really very nice and very, incredibly valuable. Though I don't want to assign a value to that, but it's incredibly precious when you get those highs. But I think the biggest thing in my mind, and go back to what I've already said, is at some point you have to remind yourself that there is a difference between passion and emotion. When you're going through the lows, you don't want to go on a low that it affects you personally, which means you have to take the emotion out of it when it happens. And again, this realization, people actually don't. And my daughter is she studied psychology, so she's a PhD in psychology. I've seen people not focus on their mental health as much as they do on their physical health. And it's so critical to do that. When you're going through these, volatile situations, and there have been many, as I said, that is incredibly important for you to remember that mental health is as important. I think that is where that's where I've learned to deal with this. You know, if I'm going through a low, and I've now become a little bit good at this, I can switch off the emotion like this. Flip a switch. And then it all becomes very crystal clear. Hey, what am I doing? In the big scheme of things, this is so small. I don't have to be stressed about it. So let's pick up, start again. And that becomes a new day. And that's how you have this joy of waking up in the morning and saying, hey, I want to go back to work. It's such a great feeling. Such a great feeling. And you can only do this if you can, sometimes pull this out, emotion out, and say, now let's figure out and focus on the passion. And that makes any down, no matter how low you are, no matter if things are going really, really badly, it kind of pulls you up and says, go, get this done.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. So separating passion from emotion and ensuring that the emotion doesn't come in the way of any particular situation, because in the larger scheme of things, it more or less will be all right. Wow, that's wonderfully awesome and a great way to end the episode. Thank you so much, Monish, for a phenomenal conversation. I mean, I have taken up so much from this last 1 hour of our conversation, from the engineering mindset to dreaming and achieving being in our control, and to respecting our own time and ensuring what values we have. I think it's just been phenomenal, one and all. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. And thank you so much for being on the show.
I have, Yuvraj. So thank you once again for having me on the show. Really appreciate it and look forward to, more shows from you. I've become a big fan of yours. So thank you so much.
That's extremely kind of you, and this was super awesome. Thank you so much. Awesome. I'm truly blown away by that conversation. Monish's candid insights, humble demeanor, and incredible ambition is absolutely iconic and positively contagious. With that, we come to the end of the 66th episode with Monish Darda, the co-founder and CTO of iCertis. Thank you so much for listening in. I really hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. If you're finding value with the podcast, do follow it on the audio streaming platform of your choice, drop in a review, share it on social media, or subscribe to our WhatsApp newsletter to get all the updates directly on your inbox. Thanks again. I will see you next week for another episode. Till then, I hope you recall. If you never try, you'll never know. Stay tuned and keep building.